So Esther 3, verse 1 to 6 is what I'll be reading out to start off with. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agai, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down to him or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke of him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet, learning who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. And now going on to Esther 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put sackcloth and ashes and went down into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went out only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict an order of the king came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him, and instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned, Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay.
Hi everyone, I'm really glad to be here this morning. For those that don't know me, my name is Ty. I go to the evening service usually, and I joined Christchurch London in January 2015, so over 7.5 years ago, which is a long time. In addition to that, I also work for church. I obviously work with Joel and Peter, and used to work with Daniel, which is and was amazing, and yes, they did pay me to say that. I'm kidding, you guys are great, love you. I'm really excited to be continuing our series on Esther. So following on from Sarah's talk last week, we'll be focusing more on chapters 3 and 4 of the book. So to recap where we are in the story, Haman has been elevated by King Xerxes, and he's getting pretty full of himself. Like, everyone is bowing down to him. He's loving life. But upon finding out that Mordecai is refusing to bow down to him and show him honor, he devises, and also the fact that he's a Jew, he devises this plan to basically kill all the Jews throughout all the land of Persia. Haman approaches King Xerxes and basically gets him to agree to this plan, and a decree is issued that all the Jews would be killed on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. Mordecai is obviously distressed by this. We're told that he tears his clothes and he goes to the gate wailing. And Esther obviously has no idea what's going on, as she lives most of her life secluded in the palace. But upon hearing about Mordecai, she basically sends a messenger to him to basically inquire, like, what's going on? Like, he's distressed, he's wailing, what's happening? And then Mordecai basically explains to Esther everything that's gone on, explains about the decree, and basically asks her to go to the king to intercede on behalf of the Jews. So it's from here that I really want to focus. I think there's a lot we can learn throughout the chapters of chapter 3 and chapter 4 about Esther, but I think there are three things in particular that we can really pick up from the story. So I'm just going to jump right in. So I think the first point that we can really pick out is that Esther understood the position she was in. So what did she understand about her position? Well, firstly, she understood that she was in a precarious one. It was the law that no one approached the king unless they had been summoned. And Esther hadn't been called to go to the king for like 30 days. So now Mordecai is not only asking her to go to the king unsummoned, he's asking her to intercede on behalf of the Jews, which would ultimately mean that she would have to reveal her own identity. And that's a big deal, as like we're told in chapter 2 that Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. So to give some cultural context to this, the Jews at this time are in exile under the Persian Empire. And there's a lot of debates around the book of Esther, but most scholars date it between 483 and 473 BC, which would basically place it between the books of Agai and Zechariah and Ezra and Nehemiah. So Cyrus the Great was obviously the first Persian ruler, and he obviously showed some partiality to the Jews insofar as he allowed the Jews to go back and rebuild the temple. But we kind of get the impression that not everything was rosy for the Jews under Persian occupation. Basically, we're told in the books of Ezra, mainly chapter 4, that there was a lot of opposition to the rebuilding, basically throughout the reign of Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, and even Artaxerxes. We're even given this letter by one of the Persian rulers to King Artaxerxes, which basically kind of gives us a clue as to how the Jews are perceived at this time. This is what the letter says. To King Artaxerxes from your servants in Trans-Euphrates, the king should know that the people who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid, and eventually the royal revenues will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace, and it is not proper for us to see the king dishonored, we are sending this message to inform the king, so that a search may be made in the archives of your predecessors. In these records, you will find that the city is a rebellious city, troublesome to kings and provinces, a place with a long history of sedition. That is why this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are restored, you will be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. So from this letter, we kind of get the impression that the Jews aren't viewed in the best of lights, which will kind of explain the ease to which Haman agrees to, or King Xerxes agrees to Haman's plans, and probably why Esther would feel some apprehension in revealing her identity. But now she's been asked by Mordecai to do just that. I don't know about you, but I can really relate to Esther's apprehension. Like, whilst in our cultural context, we don't face a threat from a nation, for example, we do, however, face a ideological or a philosophical threat in the form of secularism. It's often said that we live in a secular society, but what does it really mean, and how does it impact us as followers of Jesus? Well, the definitions vary, but by and large, secularism is the view that government or other institutions such as education or the media should exist separately from religion or religious beliefs. Or as Phillips Rees puts it, it is the separation of the social order from the sacred order. And within this idea, there tends to fall two camps of thought, namely hard and closed secularism and soft and open secularism. Sorry, you guys still with me? All right, great. In talking about these terms, Cosmin and Kayser in their book, Secularism and Secularity, say this. Long text, but bear with me. Hard secularism is usually more purely intellectual and personal than social or political. A precursor can be found in the writings of Hobbes, who claimed that those who follow the light of reason are bound to discard faith as intellectually unreliable and therefore morally dangerous. Following Hobbes and other like-minded philosophers, Marx suggested that faith was an ideology in contradiction to knowledge, which was used by regimes for the purpose of political control. Today's spokesmen include Richard Dawkins and Paul Kurtz. They all take hard secularism to its logical conclusion, atheism. And of soft secularism, they say this. The soft secularist individual is neither a convinced atheist nor a principled materialist and may not be hostile to religious beliefs and institutions. In fact, the majority are liberal religionists. The soft secularist is willing to take a live and let live attitude towards religion as long as it doesn't impede on his freedom of choice or seek control of public institutions. For the soft secularist, religion is a properly private lifestyle option which must not threaten liberty and social harmony in a differentiated and pluralistic society. So, based on these descriptions, I think we can surmise that the vast majority of people we meet in our daily lives, for example, at work or at the gym or even on the school run, will fall within this soft form of secularism. And whilst most people would want to hold or think they hold a neutral position in regards to not only Christianity, but all religions, I do think there has been a gradual move to this more hardline form of secularism, especially when it comes to discussions around sexual ethics, abortion, or even assisted dying. It's considered irrational, even intellectually incompatible, to refer to God and the Bible as a means of explaining the world and humanity's place within it. More so, Christians are considered or labeled as narrow-minded, ignorant, bigoted, or even hypocritical. And sadly, the legacy of the church has been just that. Often, like it's often said of Christians that we're known more for what we're against than what we're for. And I think all of this can cause us, like Esther, to want to hide our identities in fear of these preconceived notions. So this is going to probably sound like a total tonal change, but I came across a meme that made me chuckle. Honestly, and when I saw it, I was just like, I'm so going to put this in my sermon. It's like, I know, secularism to meme. Yeah, that's how I roll. This is the meme. It says, me during the job interview versus me when I get hired. And you're probably thinking, like, Ty, how on earth does this even apply? Like, make it make sense. Like, but honestly, when I saw it, I was just like, you know what? Like, that can be me sometimes. Or rather, this is me. And the meme should come up. Basically, during my probation period, obviously when I didn't work for church, just looking over at Joel, he's like, don't worry. He knew what he was getting when he hired me. He's like, I think so anyway. But basically, during my probation period, I could only be described as like the human embodiment of the smiling sweat emoji. Like literally, colleagues would ask me like, oh, how was your weekend? And I'd be like, yes, good, really good, yes, thanks for asking. And then they'd be like, oh, what did you get up to? And then I'd be like, you know. Things, just things, you know, yeah, super cash, just things, yeah. And then basically after my probation period, basically when I felt a little bit more, when I felt a little bit more settled, a little bit more secure, Then I felt more comfortable to share the fact that I was a Christian. And then I ended up having like really interesting conversations with colleagues about like the existence of God, objective morality, aliens. And it literally sounds like a joke, but I had literally had a colleague ask me what the Christian perspective on the existence of aliens was. Like a really fascinating conversation. If anyone wants to know my thoughts on it, definitely ask me after the service. But although this is a really silly example, I think it points to the tension that we can often feel when we enter into public spaces, especially places of work. But what I love about Esther is like, although she understood that she was in a precarious position, she also understood that God had placed her there for a reason. And I should probably caveat this by saying she eventually understood. Basically, I love this exchange between Esther and Mordecai in chapter 4. Basically, Esther is giving all the reasons why she can't approach the king, why it'd be dangerous for her to approach the king. And Mordecai kind of responds and he gives her this really pointed challenge. He says this, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." For Mordecai, there was no doubt that God would come through for the Jews, but he was inviting Esther to see that there was a divinely ordered plan for her life, and this was her moment of destiny. And because of fear, she was in danger of missing it. And I think that can be true of us. Like, I don't know if you've ever wondered, like, why you're the only Christian in your family, for example, or why you're the only Christian in your team, let alone your entire workplace. Could it be that God has placed you there for a reason, and there's an opportunity for you to bring some of God's kingdom to where you are? I think often when we feel like we're the only ones, the default position is to hide and lay low and not tell people I'm a Christian and just do what I did and just, you know, tell them you're up to things on the weekend, you know? But that's not what we're called to do. I love this passage in Matthew 5. So Matthew 5, 14 to 16, it says this, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." This is what we are. We are light. We're not called to hide, but to glorify God's name and display his glory to the world. Like your presence, our collective presence as Christians, matters to a broken world desperately in need of Jesus. But ultimately, it takes courage. I love the journey that Esther goes through these chapters. She basically moves from a position of fear to an understanding of what she's been called to do, then to courageous obedience. The very thing she was afraid to lose, her life, is a thing she now relinquishes, so much so that she says, "If I perish, I perish." It's really interesting. In preparing for this sermon, I came across the story of Janani Jakalia Luwum. And if there are any Ugandans here today or anyone watching online, I apologize for my poor pronunciation. He basically was the Archbishop of the Church of Uganda between 1974 and 1977, and one of the most influential leaders of the modern church in Africa. Basically, in February 1977, in protest to the arbitrary killings and unexplained disappearances at the hand of the Ugandan military officer and President Idi Amin, he together with a number of other bishops basically met to write a letter in protest to these killings. Archbishop Luwum was actually the one who went to meet President Amin. A lot of these names are tricky. to deliver the letter to him. So what happened was he was accused of treason and basically arrested and killed. It's reported that as he was being taken away, he turned to one of the other bishops and he basically said, "They are going to kill me. I am not afraid," which is just like incredible. His picture or his statue is actually among the 20th century martyrs at the front of Westminster Abbey in London, which again is like incredible. But I don't know if you're anything like me, but when I hear stories like his, or stories like of Martin Luther King, or Rosa Parks, or Mother Teresa, I can often feel like, wow, they're so courageous. I could never do that. I'm not that courageous. But I think courage takes different forms. So to give you an example from my life, some of you may know that prior to becoming a designer, I worked in law. My very first job out of uni was basically at a law firm specializing in personal injury. And before anyone asks, no, I was not the person calling asking if you'd been in an accident. That was not me. The people I called had actually been in an accident and they knew I was calling them. Just wanted to clarify. But anyway, my manager at the time, and we'll call her Sally for the purposes of the story, was the type of person that if she was in a good mood, it affected the whole office. And if she was in a bad mood, it affected the whole office. And unfortunately, she was in a bad mood 80% of the time. Like, she's such a toxic place. Probably one of the worst jobs I've worked at. But anyway, a year into me working there, the senior execs decided to bring in a new female manager to help assist Sally in her role. So she came in, and obviously, Sally didn't like that. So what she proceeded to do was effectively bully this new manager. She basically like put her down at every opportunity. She undermined her work. She was just pretty cruel. And basically, because everyone in the office was terrified of Sally, they mostly gave this new manager a wide berth. So, bar from talking to her about cases, they mostly ignored her. So there I was, 21, 22. I had no power. I was the most junior person on the team. I couldn't really tell Sally to like stop being horrible. So I did the only thing I thought to do, and that was effectively to show this new manager love. And I knew it wouldn't win me any favors with Sally. In fact, she actually treated me worse after that. But I persisted. And I didn't really do anything that amazing. What I did was, like, if I was making myself a tea, I'd offer her a tea. I'd ask her about her weekends. I'd try and make conversation, which was often tricky because she was, like, 20 years older than me and we had nothing in common. But anyway. So I want to say that my act of like defiant kindness like overthrew Sally's reign and she stopped being mean and like everything worked out. It didn't. Basically, the new manager eventually left and sued the company for constructive dismissal. But when she left, I was the only person she said bye to, and I was the person she asked to pack up her things. So why do I tell you this story? Well, sometimes when we choose to be obedient to God, whether it's like standing up against injustice or just simply talking to a colleague about Jesus, the results might be like that of Esther, where God completely turns a situation around and it's incredible. But sometimes it might not. But our obedience and our choosing to be courageous matters, whether to one person or to many. But like Esther, we're not called to do things in our own strength. It's fascinating. I think it's great that in chapter 4, we're told that Esther fasts for 3 days, and she also asked all the Jews, or asked Mordecai to gather all the Jews in Susa to fast for her. I think it's interesting, like in our worldly context, like the term courage is often like linked with this sense of something you have to muster up. Like, I've just got to muster up courage and I've got to find it in myself. And there are like an endless amount of articles that give you helpful tips on how you can be more courageous. But the courage Esther needed to approach the king wasn't found in herself. It was found in God. And in reverse to the world, like every time the phrase be strong and courageous is used in the Bible, it's always followed by a promise of God's faithfulness. For example, in Deuteronomy 31:6, basically when Moses is speaking to Joshua, he says, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or terrified because of them. For the Lord your God goes with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. And this is obviously repeated by God to Joshua in Joshua 1 and 9, but basically all of Joshua 1. Also in 1 Chronicles 28:20, when David is speaking to Solomon, he says, be strong and courageous, do the work. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord God, my God, is with you. and again in Chronicles 32:7, when King Ezekiah is encouraging his officials, he says, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged because of the king of Assyria and the vast army with him, for there is a greater power with us than with him." In each instance, there's an appeal for courage, not because it's natural for man to be brave and courageous, but because when God is guiding us and protecting us, we can be confident in him. We can trust that he's with us every step of the way. This sermon's probably a little bit short, but I just wanted to invite the band back up. And before I do that, they should come up. You come up before I close. Before I ended the sermon, I wanted to say, like, I think often, sometimes the response to a sermon like this can be twofold. Sometimes we can have this feeling of like, oh, I just need to do more. I need to be more courageous. I need to tell every single person I know about Jesus. Or we can have this feeling like, oh, I don't have to do anything because, you know, ultimately God doesn't need us and like he's in control and he can do it all. But what I'd say to both is like, we're not called to do things in our own strength. God isn't calling us to build the church. He builds the church. We're just called to be diligent and serve wherever he's placed us. And secondly, it's an amazing privilege that whatever our circumstances, whatever our family background, whatever our age or marital status, that God would choose to use us, whether in a big or small ways, to bring some of his kingdom here on earth. So, before the band lead us in worship, I just really wanted to read Psalm 121 over us. I think the reason I wanted to read it is because the reality is we will face challenges. That's guaranteed. The world is getting tougher. There's so much division, and we can feel a bit hopeless. We might feel like we want to hide, but God is with us. He's for us. He'll never leave us nor forsake us. So this is what Psalm 121 says. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. So let's stand and worship together.